Welcome back to Morning Ireland. Millions of people around the world are expected to take part in rallies today in the Global Day of Action on Climate Change. They've started in Australia with students carrying placards, one reading, "We didn't light it, but we're trying to fight it." Another one, "The oceans are rising and so are we." Here's what those protests sounded like in Sydney.
Fossil fuels that would tip us over the tipping points, that would take us into catastrophic temperatures.
Stop drowning, Taylor!
Hey, Scarborough, we're talking to you!
Well, the movement led by school children staying out of school or striking was instigated by Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg. Today's rallies come ahead of a UN Climate Action Summit in New York on Monday. More than a million students are expected on the streets there today. Here, thousands of students are expected to demonstrate. There will be 10 large protests around the country. Our environment and science correspondent George Lee joins us now in the studio. So, George, let's talk about first what's happening here. What are we going to see across the country?
Well, there's a lot of activities are strikes and other actions as such planned. It's the biggest one that we've seen so far. We had a very big demonstration, I think it was in March, where there was about 15,000 students out on a big demonstration in Dublin and all over the country. Then there were other echoes. This one looks as if it has the potential to be bigger because the organisation is more, more significant in it. What's going on in nearly every town, or nearly every large town, there is a big demonstration, and there are all of the side issues which the students have asked adults to participate in this occasion, and they're being backed by the trade unions, by CIPTU, by FORSA, by the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, by religious groups, by academics and scientists in the likes of UCD, DCU, all over the country. Now, they can't strike if you're in work for this because it's not an issue between you and your employer, and so they're there on the sidelines with joining activities at lunchtimes and stuff like that and supporting them and stewarding what's going to go on. In Dublin, for instance, if you take some of the main ones which are going to happen in Ireland, in Dublin the students will be gathering around Customs House Quay at about 12 o'clock, then march to Merrion Square, and there they'll have a rally in front of government buildings, and it's expected to go on until about 2 o'clock. In Cork City, they're gathering at Grand Parade from about 12, and they're marching from about 12:20. In Kerry, they're going to meet in Tralee at the county building in Rathaus around 9 a.m, so that's an early one. In Ennis, in Clare, they're going to meet at the height in O'Connell Square at 9 a.m, again another early one. But if you go to Drogheda, they're demonstrating from 1 o'clock outside St. Peter's Church. In Galway, demonstrating from about 4 in Eyre Square. In Navan, from about 1 until 3 at Market Square. In Limerick, they're marching from Arthur's Quay Park at 1 o'clock, finishing at City Hall. In Dundalk, they're demonstrating from about 12:30 to 3 o'clock at Market Square. In Kenmare and Kerry, from 9 o'clock till 1 o'clock outside the courthouse. And all over the country and lots of other places, there are events in Sligo, events in Waterford, and very many more.
And so remind us, George, I suppose, what exactly is it that they're looking for?
Well, they're looking for climate action, really. They're looking for the fact that the government here, for instance, in Ireland, what they will claim is that the government has already accepted that they have been a laggard in relation to climate action, and during the period and the decades when no action was taken, that there has been environmental degradation. They want the government to improve its act in relation to what it is that they're doing, and do much more. The trade union are backing all of that. Patricia King, the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, issued a statement yesterday saying they have been calling for the setting up of a just transition task force, and so they're looking for the government to make significant movements in relation to that. Richard Bruton, in relation to this, has said that he is listening to all of this. He says that young people have led the way in highlighting the urgency of climate action, and it's important that the decision makers listen to them and take note of their experiences. And he said he's heard those voices protesting today. They're paying testament to the damage that is being done to their inheritance, and they have a message for governments but also for every sector of society. He says that now is the time to take action to protect their future. So he certainly looks as if he's on board, but they have no intention of letting him off the hook with just a statement.
And the Minister will be joining the Taoiseach and other world leaders in New York on Monday. Just tell us what's happening at the Climate Action Summit in New York.
Well, the Climate Action Summit, they're trying to make progress in relation to very big decisions which need to be taken about who does what in relation to climate action. The last big summit wasn't a summit, IPCC. That's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which met last year in November in Katowice in Poland, and they failed to make some progress on fairly significant things in terms of how you measure some of these climate targets and the various actions that government need to do and how they will be held to account. They need to bang heads together in relation to that at this summit in New York, and they're hoping to make some progress. Also in relation to funding for poorer countries, about who's going to help them to get out of the mess that they're in, given that it is richer countries who have put all the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And that really is leading towards the next IPCC meeting, which is going to be in Chile in early December. So they're trying to get all the ducks in a row. It's very, very difficult. And I think that this has become clear in relation to some of the issues. Greta Thunberg, for instance, this is the Swedish teenage climate activist who started all this. And remember, barely over a year ago, this young girl who was 15 at the time, who describes herself as being an Asperger, a person who hasn't the Asperger syndrome, sat herself in front of the parliament in Sweden, and this has all started from that.
And she's been appearing in front of the US government this week. She's been at a few different House committees there. How did that go for her?
For her, it was. It sounded like she certainly served her purpose in terms of bringing great attention to the issue. A lot of the congressmen pointed out that she was a teenager and that more or less a child, and that these were big, difficult decisions. And she said, I don't want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to the scientists. And she said her submission to Congress in terms of her statement was the IPCC report on the 1.5 degrees centigrade, which was produced about a year ago, in which the IPCC scientists were pointing out the absolute difference in devastation between 2 degrees warming and 1.5 degrees warming, hundreds of millions of people displaced and all sorts of damage to nature. And she said, listen to the scientists. And she's not saying that she has all the answers, but that is exactly what she's saying. You know, there may be a novelty in terms of her coming along to US senators and US congressmen and pointing it out, but she's not claiming that she has the answers, but she's claiming that the scientists will tell them what to do, which is the big difficulty. Because although, and as you see with Richard Bruton, he's looking to do all of these things, it's really hard. It's one thing to point out the problems, it's one thing to listen to scientists, it's very difficult because some of the solutions that policymakers would be willing to swallow just aren't there. It's difficult to tackle all of this, and that's what all of this movement is going to highlight.
Okay, George, thank you very much. George Lee, our environment and science correspondent. And a bit later in the programme, we'll be hearing from two Irish students who'll be taking part in today's action protests.
Quinn executives told to install panic rooms. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Times, where it's reported that executives at Quinn Industrial Holdings have also been advised by Gardaí not to stop their cars for any reason on the road on foot of threats which have been issued to them and the abduction of the company's chief operating officer, Kevin Lunny, on Tuesday evening. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Daily Mail quotes the Taoiseach's assertion yesterday that we need to see arrests and convictions arising out of the investigation into Mr. Lunny's kidnapping. The Irish Independent leads today with the line that Google is willing to subsidise housing in Dublin to ease the accommodation crisis. The story arises out of Adrian Weckler's interview with Google CEO Sundar Pichai. The paper also runs with the lead editorial related to that story under the headline, Google's housing proposals deserve a decent hearing. And elsewhere in the paper, Mark Keenan examines the history of companies providing housing for their workers. Home Truth, philanthropic housing has long been used to control working classes, is the headline there. The Echo also leads with a housing-related story today, reporting that an average of 100 applicants are competing for each social house that becomes available in Cork County. Over 400 Garda attacks in 3 years, that's the lead headline in today's Irish Examiner, which also quotes the Garda Representative Association saying that in reality, the numbers are far higher since that figure only reflects reported attacks. Prominent Belfast solicitor Michael Brentnall has accused the PSNI of attempting to intimidate and harass him. That's according to the lead story in today's Irish News, which reports that it has also emerged that the police ombudsman has already upheld 3 other complaints which he made against the PSNI. Mr. Brentnall, who is well known for his human rights work and regularly handles troubles-related cases, has also taken a High Court case against the police. His most recent complaint relates to the way police handled a threat which had been made against him. An excerpt from David Cameron's biography, in which he talks about coming face to face with members of the IRA during talks in Stormont in 2014, provides the lead story in the Belfast Telegraph. And the Irish Daily Mirror leads with a story about how Maura Higgins threatened to storm out of Love Island after a series of meltdowns during her time on the ITV show. An ESRI study has found that people order less and consume fewer calories when calorific information is included on menus. That's on the front of the Times. And finally, the Irish Daily Star and Herald both lead today with identical headlines related to the video which was widely circulated on news and social media platforms yesterday, showing a rat emerging from a sliced pan in the Apple Green service station in Cherry Orchard in Dublin, which has been temporarily closed down as a result of that video. Rat the Baker is the headline in both of those papers this morning.
And in Limerick, the Environmental Protection Agency has granted a licence to Irish Cement to burn waste at its site in Mungret. The provisional decision will allow the company to move away from using fossil fuels at the plant, which employs 80 people. But the decision has provoked fury among some residents and members of the Limerick Against Pollution group. One of its members, Angus Mitchell, spoke to our reporter Eilish Sheehy.
We're obviously very disappointed and pretty dumbfounded, principally because we've carried out a lot of detailed investigation over the last 4 years, and therefore we thought we had a very good chance that the EPA would at least apply the precautionary principle with this license application.
What kind of impact will this have on the area?
Well, it will have a huge impact. Principally, it'll have a reputational impact because Limerick is at the moment trying to build its reputation. The Mungret cement works is in the city now. I mean, the fastest expanding side of the city is that side that leads from Raheen to Mungret. There are hundreds of new houses there. And that's really very much really in the shadow of the cement works. What city wants a huge, faulty, old cement works burning 3,500 tyres a day, belching out emissions.
Do you feel this will drive people from the area?
Of course it will. I mean, they're already leaving.
What's planned? What action now is Limerick Against Pollution going to take in response to this decision?
Well, we've got a whole suite of different forms of response to what's happening. I mean, we're going to, on one level, obviously appeal, and then we're going to have a big protest march through the city on the 5th of October, and we hope to, you know, attract hundreds if not thousands of people to that.
And that was Angus Mitchell there from Limerick Against Pollution. Well, we can talk now to Nick Rabbits, who's a journalist with the Limerick Leader newspaper. He's in our Limerick studio this morning. Nick, good morning.
Good morning to you.
And thank you very much for joining us. Mungret, first of all, is it a high residential area?
It is. It's one of the fastest growing parts of the city now. There's permission in place for 800 houses under the public Limerick 2030 plan. And there's also three new schools which have just recently opened in the area. So it is one of the fastest growing parts of Limerick. And a few years ago, Irish Cement lodged a planning permission to do something broadly similar. At that time, it kind of passed off without notice because there was really no one or very few people living in this area at the time. Things have moved on.
And tell us, what waste will Irish Cement, as a result of this decision, be allowed to burn?
They're going to be allowed to burn used tyres, which they're piling up around sites around the country, and solid recovered waste. Now, that's a very catch-all expression, as you can imagine. It emerged during the course of an oral hearing a couple of years ago, an Ambol Panola oral hearing here in Limerick, that there'll be all manner of waste that the company will be allowed to burn under this licence, including the likes of animal feed and other litter, which, you know, is kind of quite significant.
But the company want to do this to allow it to move away from using fossil fuel.
Yeah, it's an irony because the company's approach is that they feel that they're becoming more environmentally friendly by switching away from pet coke, which I think they're one of the few remaining factories in Europe to use pet coke in the production of cement. They feel that switching away and using these tyres and these pieces of waste will make the factory more environmentally friendly, as you've heard from Angus Mitchell there. Protesters feel it'll be the exact opposite. It'll be a real a bigger danger to the environment.
But the company says they want to bust a few myths, I suppose. They say that there aren't going to be a million tyres a month burned. It'll be a million tyres per year. And that burning tyres, while it may sound harmful, they say that the way that they will be burnt, they'll be burnt inside a cement kiln. Mm. So it's complete combustion, extreme temperatures. It means there'll be no smoke, no fumes, no increase in emissions.
And that's something that the company constantly points out. And they also make the point that this is the only way Irish Cement in Limerick, they're a big employer in Limerick, they still have 80 people on their books. I mean, it's down from pre-recession levels, you know. They still have a huge amount of people on their books, and they're saying that this is the only way they can remain competitive. This is the only way to secure the jobs in the factory in Mungret.
Yeah, and they say they're currently wading through the decision, their words, and they're not going to comment any further. But what will happen now? Will there be an appeal of this decision, Nick?
It's the devil's in the detail, rather, because what it is people can, and I was speaking to a councillor about this yesterday afternoon, people can appeal to have changes to the licence that the EPA have given. But from what I understand, the licence is given by the EPA. That can't be revoked or removed. People can appeal against it to say, at the moment, for example, Irish Cement have permission to burn 90,000 tonnes of this material a year. They might... people might try and appeal it and get it down to, say, 60,000 a year.
Okay.
Likewise, Irish Cement could go the other way and say, well, look, we need to burn more. And I think that's a big fear of a lot of the protest groups like Limerick Against Pollution. They feel that Irish Cement could appeal this and say, well, look, no, we want to go up to 120. We need this to remain competitive.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on it. Thank you very much indeed. Nick Rabbits there from the Limerick Leader, 7:26.
Now, tonight is Culture Night, and one of the new additions to the calendar is the Museum of Irish Literature, or MOLLY, which opens to the public for the first time this evening. It's based in Newman House on St Stephen's Green in Dublin, and as our arts and media correspondent Sinead Crowley now reports, it aims to showcase a wide range of Irish literature, from the classics right up to the present day.
Oh, winter hers, winter here, dear.
James Joyce is there on the literary landscape. For a Dubliner, he is a fantastic writer.
It's a museum dedicated to writers and writing, but the first thing that hits you when you enter the Museum of Literature Ireland is a wall of sound. One room in particular brings visitors through a river run of language. Margaret Kelleher is Professor of Anglo-Irish Literature at UCD.
Early on in the project, we were chatting with the exhibition designers and they asked us, what is our content asset? The quick answer is 1,500 years of literary history in two or more languages. And the way we've brought that to life is in this installation, River Run of Language. It's a place where visitors can see and hear the sounds of Irish writing. They can encounter 10th century Digda, but also Nuala Ní Gonaill, Paul Muldoon, and so many other writers from today.
MOLLY, the name itself is a tribute to Joyce's Ulysses, is located in Newman House on Stephen's Green in Dublin.
UCD was founded here in 1854, and this is a beautiful Victorian building going back to that time. It's known to generations of UCD students as an exam hall. There were student hops here, there were discos here. But these are buildings charged with literary history. This is where James Joyce studied, it's where Maeve Binchy set Circle of Friends, and it's where Flann O'Brien was up to quite a bit of mischief.
The major names of Irish literature are of course represented here, but so too are newer writers. They're an important part of the story, according to museum director Simon O'Connor.
At the core of the exhibitions, we have the display of these wonderful collections from the National Library, these Joycean treasures. We have Ulysses copy number one, the very famous first copy that was published. We have his Ulysses notebooks on display. But we are also trying to take the capital L out of literature. I mean, this is a subject that's for everybody. So many people in Ireland read, but they're not all reading Finnegan's Wake. You know, they're reading crime fiction, they're reading horror fiction, and there are very young readers. And we want 10-year-olds to come in and see the books and the writers that they're reading in this museum too.
The gardens outside are in marked contrast to the words within.
This garden has always been part of Newman House. In fact, actually, the ash tree behind me was the tree that James Joyce had his graduation photograph taken against when he graduated from UCD here. We've re-landscaped these gardens as well, so we felt, you know, we should really try and create a beautiful garden for people to sit in. So a lot of the planting is focused on colours that change over time, scent, it's constantly changing smell. We've planted to attract songbirds, really trying to create a reader's oasis right here in the middle of the city.
I write all day. I write all day. I'm always writing. I do very little else. I make a space in my life that is full of writing.
Also included in the exhibition are voices of the writers themselves.
Visitors can get to listen to people like Roddy Doyle, John Banville, Anne Enright, Nuala McGonnell, Leila Sinquivna, all talking about their writing process and, you know, how they face the blank page, the types of rooms that they write in, and it really demystifies the process. And I think that's actually really inspiring for visitors, and certainly for me, that, you know, the real work is just getting on with it and just writing, and hopefully we might prompt visitors to start a writing project themselves.
I do know that I took my pulse once when I was in the middle of a long day's work, and it was lower than it was when I had taken it at rest that morning. I was interested in my heart rate. So it is a very meditative state, or a state of flow.
And that was the voice of Anne Enright ending that report from Sinead Crowley. Hundreds of thousands of people are expected to take part in cultural and artistic events across the country tonight, and we'll have more on some of those events later in the programme. Just gone 7:30.
Hi Audrey, good morning. ESB Group has reported an operating profit of €294 million in its interim results for the 6 months to the end of June. The group continues to invest in energy infrastructure, a capital investment of €396 million to help deliver a low carbon energy future. The online payments firm Stripe, founded by Limerick brothers Patrick and John Collison, is raising a further $250 million in new funding. The latest round values the company at $35 billion. Apple Green has reported an increase in group revenue of 73% to €1.5 billion in its interim results for the 6 months to the end of June. Gross profit at the fuel and service station operator increased by 145% to €268 million. Wicklow Wolf opens its new brew house and taproom in Newtown Mount Kennedy today. The brewers are also moving to more sustainable packaging and swapping bottles for cans. Let's take a look at the currencies. €1 buys 87.9 pence sterling and $1 10.5 cents.
24 minutes to 8. Well, John, my jersey's ready. Is yours?
It is, yes. Ironed and all, yes. Yeah. The big day, Maggie, has finally arrived. Rugby World Cup 2019 gets underway later this morning when hosts Japan take on Russia in Ireland's Pool A. It kicks off at 11:45. There'll be the normal opening ceremony beforehand in Tokyo Stadium. Coverage begins on RTE2 television at 10 o'clock. From an Irish perspective, the team to play Scotland on Sunday was announced by Joe Schmidt in the last half an hour. Jordan Larmour will play at full back, Andrew Conway and Jacob Stockdale on the wings, Bundy Aki and Gary Ringrose in the centre, and Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton at half back. The front row is made up of Keane Healy, Rory Best and Tadhg Furlong. Second rows are James Ryan and Dean Henderson, and the back row is made up of Peter O'Mahony, Josh van der Fleer and CJ Stander, and the replacements are Niall Scannell, Dave Kilcoyne, Andrew Porter, Tadhg Byrne, Jack Conan, Luke McGrath, Jack Carty and Chris Farrell. So what to make of the team and squad chosen? From Yokohama City, here's Michael Corcoran.
I mean, it was well flagged during the course of the week that Rob Kearney and Keith Earls were nursing their way back to fitness, so they were unlikely to be included. Robbie Henshaw has a bit of a problem with the hamstring and is kind of penciling provisionally for a return against Japan next week. Kearney and Earls, I mean, the good news from their point of view is that it's nothing major. I mean, if this was the final game of the season, you could certainly include the two of them in the starting team. And the good news also, just from an injury point of view, is that Joey Carberry trained fully during the course of the week and looks set to return to be in action against Japan next week. In terms of the composition of the team, I mean, just a couple of talking points there. The centre was always going to be Bundy Aki plus one, depending on who was fit or otherwise. So, you know, Gary Ringrose slots in there. Chris Farrell is on the bench and can play alongside Bundy. you could, in a situation, see, for example, Jordan Lerner could jump into that position too. Andrew Conway. I mean, the back three are all kind of interchangeable. So it's basically trying to make the most of the players that are available. Obviously, Sexton and Conor Murray are first choice at half-back, as indeed are the front row. The second row was always going to be James Ryan plus one. Now, the plus one on this occasion is Ian Henderson. I mean, you've got someone like Jean Klein, who's not in the match at 23, can slot in alongside James Ryan if required. And the composition of the back row, I think that's probably the first choice back row that we have there. I know that Peter O'Mahony's played seven. CJ Stander could play six. Jack Conor could come in. That could be an alternative back row, but he's gone with the sort of first choice back row, if I can call it that, of Peter O'Mahony, Josh van der Fleer at seven, and CJ Stander at eight. But I mean, we've got a really strong looking bench with Niall Scannell on the bench. Kilcoyne and Porter will obviously have a big part to play as well, but Tadhg Byrne adds his own dynamic off the bench also. Jack Conan there too. And then we literally have just got three backs who are pretty fit. That's Luke McGrath, Jack Carthy, and Chris Farrell there. So, you know, given the fact that we have some injuries and players returning from injury, this is the team, maybe not the team that Joe had in mind, a couple of weeks back in terms of starting against Scotland, but in terms of the fully fit and available players, this is the team and the best team that Joe Schmidt can put out to play Scotland here in Yokohama on Sunday afternoon.
Michael Corcoran there. So what to expect from Ireland on Sunday? This is what Joe Schmidt had to say at the team announcement.
One thing I will be really confident of is that we will be tough to beat. That in 48 hours' time, I think you'll see a very collective effort, and that effort will make us tough to beat. Now, I've no doubt that the Scots are working away and going to make sure that there's something similar. I don't think there's a huge amount between the two teams, and so whoever does maybe get the bounce of the ball or can be just a little bit more efficient than the other, it may just tip the balance. There's certainly things that you do hold back a bit. I've no doubt we'll see something from Scotland that we haven't seen before, because we've been planning this for a long time, and when you get the opportunity to put it into practice, it still has to be put into practice accurately, and one of the things that gets in the way of that is the amount of pressure the opposition can put on you, and I've no doubt that both teams will be trying to put pressure on each other so that whatever they have got planned isn't quite as effective as they'd hoped.
And we'll have Eddie O'Sullivan in studio here at 8:30 to discuss the Irish team announcement and the prospects for the weekend, the first weekend of the Rugby World Cup. In Europa League soccer, three wins, a draw and a defeat for the British teams in action last night. Teenage winger Bukayo Saka scored his first goal for Arsenal as the Gunners beat 10-man Eintracht Frankfurt 3-0 away from home. Manchester United made heavy work of beating Kazakhstan's side Astana. The deadlock was eventually broken after 73 minutes by 17-year-old Mason Greenwood in the 1-0 win at Old Trafford. In Group E, Rennes and Celtic drew 1-1, Ryan Christie scoring from the penalty spot for Celtic, who had Bio sent off late on. Rangers won 1-0 at home to Feyenoord, Ojo with the goal, but Wolves were beaten 1-0 at Molineux by Portuguese side Braga. The Irish contingent are well off the pace after the opening round of the BMW PGA Championship at Wentworth. Paul Dunn shot an 80, Rory McIlroy a 76, Padraig Harrington a 73, and the best of the bunch was Open champion Shane Lowry, whose level par 72 with some seven shots behind first round leader Matt Wallace. Meanwhile, on the PGA Tour, a great start by Waterford's Seamus Power in the Sanderson Farms Championship. He shot a 7 under par 65 to lie just one shot off the lead held by Tom Hogue. There's racing today at Ballinrobe. The first is off at 3:30, and for sports news updates throughout the day, check out the RTE News Now app and rte.ie. Audrey.
Prisons here are overcrowded. More than 4,000 people are now in custody on a regular basis. That's a rise of 11% in the past 2 years. The figures are contained in the Prison Service's new strategic plan for the next 3 years, which has just been published. It also shows a 59% increase in the numbers of women being sent to prison, a 25% increase in prisoners on remand, and an increase in the number of sex offenders behind bars too. Well, we asked for an interview with the Director General of the Prison Service
this morning, but she wasn't available. We are joined in studio now by Fina Ní Cineda, Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust, which campaigns for a penal policy which uses prison as a last resort. Fina, you're very welcome and thank you for coming in to us. You were consulted on this strategic plan, part of a wide range of groups who were. We talk about those figures, a 59% increase in the numbers of women being sent to prison. I think there's now 179 women in 133 spaces, which don't add up. Why are such large numbers of women being sent to prison?
Well, in a nutshell, it shows that social policy is failing. From 2012 to 2017, we saw an overall reduction in the number of people being committed to prison. But during that time, the numbers of women being committed to prison continued to rise year on year. There is cross-agency, cross-party, cross-government consensus that prison is an inappropriate response to offending by women in the vast majority of cases.
Why are they in prison?
Why women have very complex needs. Women who offend have very complex needs. 85% have addictions issues. Around 60% have mental health care issues. The rates of homelessness are higher among women, and also they have very poor outcomes on release of prison. So what you find are that there's a high return rate of women to prison.
Are they in primarily for drugs offences?
So about 35 to 40% under sentence who are committed under sentence are serving sentences of less than 12 months. So this is obviously for less serious offences. And we're deeply concerned about this because, in law since 2011, a law was introduced. Judges are obliged to consider community service in lieu of sentences of less than 12 months. This recognises that prison is damaging in itself, and in fact very short sentences have been found to increase public safety risks rather than decrease them, because it may offer the community short-term respite from low-level persistent offending, but it creates so many other issues through breakdown in accommodation and services and treatment and lack of continuity.
Well, that's an issue, isn't it? Because the strategic plan deals with that as well. This when there's nowhere for the people to go on release from prison, the high risk of reoffending, because there's no houses, there's no accommodation for them.
There's no accommodation. People are released, and this is right up the range from short-term sentencing right up to people who have been released after very long sentences. They put in the work, they try their hardest, they're released from prison, they come out ready to engage with opportunities. What happens is, for example, they might be released into a hostel where they're accommodated along people who are current drug users. So we're setting people up to a fail. But we have to look at what's happening at the front door end, which is last year of 4,300 people who were committed to prison, 70% were for sentences of less than 12 months. So that's over 3,000. At the same time, only 2,500 did community service orders. And going back to the women, we had 442 committals to prison, but only 291 were doing community service orders. So what we need from government is to look at this. The Department of Justice has committed to a data and research strategy. This needs to examine exactly the reasons why people are continuing, why Ireland is continuing to put people in prison instead of using less costly, non-custodial alternatives, which are more effective.
People aren't going to prison anymore, are they, for not paying fines?
Been a huge reduction. I mean, it hasn't ended, but we do recognise. So it has changed from, I think at a peak, about there were 9,000 committals for failure to pay fines. And last year, this was under 500. So this is a really welcome decrease. But still, I'm talking about 3,000 people who are, or 3,000 committals to prison for sentences of less than 12 months. The number of people committed for sentences of less than 3 months increased by 35%.
So you don't think they should be in prison at all?
Not at all. No. And I think it shows a failure in social policy. I mean, it's a line that one item of concern for us in the strategic plan is that it mentions that they're going to increase prison capacity, both for women and for men. This is not solving the problem. Full prisons are a sign that criminal justice policy is not working, and planning to increase the system is planning for the future failure of social policy. We need to see more cross-departmental work across the way. We need to address the issues that are seeing people committed for short-term sentences, and at the other end we need to see better use of structured early release programmes, which are also shown to have very good success rates.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming in to us this morning, Fina Ní Cnéada, Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust.
As millions of people around the world take part in the Global Day of Action on Climate Change, the tech giants are announcing what they're doing for the cause. Amazon pledges to be carbon neutral by 2040. The company has ordered 100,000 electric delivery vehicles to reduce its fuel consumption. Google plans to spend $2 billion in the biggest corporate purchase of renewable energy in history. But what about small businesses? What can they do? I'm joined by businesswoman Angela Rutledge, who co-owns two restaurants in Dublin, Olive's Room and Woodstock. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning, Petula.
Thanks for joining us this morning. You're trying to make environmentally friendly changes in your businesses. What are you doing and what are the challenges that you're facing?
Well, we're very lucky in one way in that Olive's Room is based in St. Anne's Park, which is Dublin City Council of Parks and Biodiversity Park. So we can work with them. Like, we have an allotment. We're able to compost all our coffee grounds by giving them to the back to the park. But when it comes to, you know, trying to reduce waste that's produced by a small business, so there's the packaging element and then there's the food waste, and about trying to make sustainable choices. It's very difficult. It's not easy. Like, my January 2019 resolution was to try and make a change in our business. So we did the basic things like, you know, changing to compostable packaging. But even there, with the cups, you have the choice between, so 2 years ago we all discovered that cups aren't recyclable. So you have to go to the recup for a recycle cup, and that's great. But then you have to wash those cups out because they won't be taken away if they're not completely clean. So that adds a labour cost, versus the compostable cups, which are actually great because in a commercial composting facility, they break down much quicker. But the recup cups are Irish, but the compostable cups come from the far side of the world. So you're trying to, you want to do the right thing for the Irish economy as well.
And when the compostable cups arrive, are they wrapped in plastic?
Yes, they are. So all the compostable packaging, which is fantastic that we have it, it all comes wrapped in single-use packaging, as does much of our dry goods and vegetables and fruit, just like you would in the supermarket. Go in and be so frustrated if you go into a supermarket to find it wrapped in plastic. It's the same for us. And it's a question of pushing back with suppliers, and they're pushing back with the factories. But it's really difficult, and you feel like you're knocking your head against a brick wall sometimes.
And if you're trying to reduce waste and choose more sustainable options, so you're reducing waste, but are you reducing costs?
Absolutely not. Nothing ever reduced costs in the food industry. So, for example, we need to use the single-use plastic gloves, because when we're making sandwiches or serving food, they are 2 cents a glove. But if you wanted to get a biodegradable one, they're 8 cents a glove. So that's just one example. Or the little jam takeaway pots, which people like if they're having a scone to go. They're 3 cents for a plastic one, but 4 cents for a compostable one.
And that's small, but it does add up.
It adds up when you're selling lots of units every day. And all of these costs add up over the course of the year. And that's where your business survives or fails.
And what are your customers saying to you?
Some of it is customer driven, and some of it's driven by your own sense of internal morality or guilt. But you will see people coming with their own cup, which is fantastic, and then they get a discount. That's part of the Conscious Cup campaign, so they bring their own keep cup. They will go mad if they see a straw in the cup that they haven't asked for, which is great. Again, we use compostable straws now, again more expensive than plastic straws, but we want to do the right thing.
And very briefly, what would you like to see happen?
I'd like to see some radical action. We took radical action smoking on the plastic bags. I'd like to see a complete ban on single-use plastic. And I'd like to see a ban on plastic bottles as well. I mean, we make money from selling bottles of water, but I would like to see those plastic bottles banned. We've moved to glass bottles, but again, there's no reason why people can't just fill up their own water bottle.
Okay. And Minister Richard Bruton has said that he would like to introduce a nationwide ban on single-use plastics, and he is considering applying fees to manufacturers who wrap supermarket products in non-recyclable plastics. I think there's due to be an announcement on that on Monday. Angela Rutledge from Olive's Room and Woodstock, thanks for joining us this morning. I know you have a festival as well in St. Anne's Park highlighting these issues tomorrow. Best of luck with that. In other business news, RBS has named Alison Rose as its new chief executive, making her the first woman to lead one of the UK's big four banks. More at 8:30. For now, back to you, Maggie.
Now, lots of people will be out and about today between the climate strike and culture night. Let's see what the weather has in store for them. And it's over to Met Éireann and Vincent O'Shea.
Good morning from Metairn. Any fog patches will clear very soon, and today will be fine and dry with variable small amounts of cloud and long sunny spells. Generally warm, highest temperatures 17 to 21 degrees, warmest in the northwest, but feeling fresher near Irish Sea and south coast as a breeze picks up. Tonight will be dry in most areas with good clear spells. Southeast winds will freshen, and then showery rain will get into southwest Munster around daybreak. Lowest temperatures 10 to 13 degrees. Tomorrow, Saturday, will begin dry for most. Good sunny spells over the north and east for a while, but rain in the southwest will spread eastwards during the afternoon and evening. The rain heavy over parts of Munster and Connacht later in the day. However, eastern areas may remain dry. Southeast winds will strengthen, highest temperatures 18 to 21 degrees. And the outlook, a spell of heavy rain will affect all areas during Saturday night, accompanied by fresh southeast winds. And Sunday then will be cloudy, cool and windy with further showers and some heavy downpours are locally possible. Monday will begin bright and dry in most places, but another batch of rain and strong winds will spread countrywide with strong southerly winds. The rain will ease for a time on Monday night and the winds will moderate. Yet more rain will fall on Tuesday, again accompanied by strong winds and temperatures falling back below normal. Some sizeable accumulations are possible, this then followed by very showery and blustery conditions for next Wednesday. The present signs are for a continuation of the distinctly unsettled, cool and windy weather for the second half of next week. Today in brief, fine, warm and dry with long spells of sunshine. Good morning.
You're listening to Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Audrey Carvel and Maggie Doyle. The news is read now by Kieran Everin.
Thousands of students are expected to demonstrate for climate action in cities and towns all over the country today as part of a global climate strike expected to be the biggest climate mobilisation the world has ever seen. It's the third such climate strike organised by Irish school students. They'll be supported and joined on this occasion by a wide range of organisations including trade unions, faith-based groups, environmental activists and other non-government bodies. Our environment and science correspondent George Lee.
An estimated 1.6 million students participated in the last global climate strike in over 2,000 cities worldwide during March earlier this year, and all the signs suggest that the numbers could be even greater this time round. The strike, which is inspired by Swedish teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg, is timed to apply pressure on world leaders attending Monday's United Nations Emergency Climate Summit in New York. Here, students will be assembling from around noon in Dublin, Cork, Galway, Limerick, Waterford, Drogheda, Navan, Dundalk, Belfast and many other towns. They will then march to rallies in central locations with the demonstrations in most places expected to last for between 2 to 3 hours. The students claim that the Irish government has been shown to be a climate laggard and that decades of inaction has led to a rise in emissions and degradation in our environment. They're calling on the government to commit to immediate and substantial action and say that by taking time off school, they will show politicians that people everywhere want climate justice.
Up to 1,000 schools face administrative disruption from today as school secretaries commence a campaign of industrial action over pay and conditions. The staff, represented by FORSA, say they've been victims of an antiquated and discriminatory two-tier pay system since 1978. The Department of Education has described the industrial action as premature and unwarranted. Our industry and employment correspondent, Ingrid Miley.
Secretaries employed by individual school management boards can earn as little as 12,500 a year, only have non-permanent contracts and must sign on when schools are closed. In contrast, other secretaries directly employed by the Department of Education enjoy public servant status along with higher pay rates, permanent contracts and pension entitlements. FORSA says it represents around a third of the 3,500 school secretaries who will this morning hold protests for around an hour at 250 schools. However, they'll also cease engagement with certain public service administrative systems, arguing that if they're not paid as public servants, they won't do public service work. Forza says this will affect administration, but not pupils. The Department of Education says it's currently carrying out a survey to establish the scale of the problem and will fully consider the claim once the costings have been established. However, the union warns that if this dispute isn't resolved soon, it will escalate.
The EU's chief Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier and the UK's Brexit Secretary Stephen Barclay are due to meet in Brussels today. Speaking ahead of today's meeting, Mr. Barclay suggested the final details of an alternative to the Irish backstop may not need to be resolved until the end of 2020. EU leaders have called on the UK to provide formal written proposals aimed at resolving the issue. The three most senior civil servants in Dublin, Belfast and London are due to speak at the 20th anniversary conference of the Centre for Cross-Border Studies in Dundalk today. The Secretary-General of the Department of the Taoiseach, Martin Fraser, the head of the Northern Ireland Civil Service, David Stirling, and the UK Cabinet Secretary, Sir Mark Sedwell, are scheduled to attend the event. The Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, will open Ireland's Digital Summit 2019 at the Convention Centre in Dublin this morning. Up to 500 invited delegates will hear keynote speeches and discussions on subjects such as the future of data and privacy, the challenges of artificial intelligence, and countering online disinformation. The Rugby World Cup gets underway in Japan later this morning when the host country takes on Russia in Ireland's group Pool A. The kick-off is at 11:45 Irish time. The 2019 competition's opening ceremony will take place beforehand in Tokyo Stadium. Coverage begins on RTE2 television at 10 o'clock. The Irish team to play Scotland in the side's opening fixture in Yokohama on Sunday was announced an hour ago by head coach Joe Schmidt.
The team to start against Scotland this Sunday is Kian Healy, Rory Best, captain, Tyke Furlong, Ian Henderson, James Ryan, Peter O'Mahony, Josh Van der Fleer and CJ Stander. And in the backs, it's Connor Murray, Jonathan Sexton, Jacob Stockdale, Bundy Aki and Gary Ringrose in the midfield, with Andrew Conway on the right wing and Jordan Lama at fullback. The replacements are Niall Scannell, Dave Kilcoyne, Andrew Porter, Tyke Byrne, Jack Conan, and their backs are Luke McGrath, Jack Carty, and Chris Farrell.
And the time is 6 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Stay safe, stay clear. Never fly a drone near overhead wires. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
Early inland mist patches will clear and it'll be a fine and dry day with variable cloud and long sunny spells. Highest temperatures of 17 to 21 degrees, warmest in the northwest. Feeling fresher near south and east coasts due to a developing southeast breeze.
The ongoing reaction to the abduction of Quinn executive Kevin Lunny earlier this week, Google's offer to build houses for its staff in Dublin, and the rat video that went viral and caused the temporary closure of a service station are some of the stories which you'll find on your front pages this morning. The Irish Times leads with the advice given to Quinn Industrial Holdings executives by Gardaí that they should install panic rooms in their houses and make sure that they don't stop their cars for any reason on the roads following the abduction of the company's chief operating officer, Kevin Lunny, on Tuesday. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Daily Mail quotes the Taoiseach's assertion yesterday that we need to see arrests and convictions arising out of that investigation. The Irish Independent leads today with the line that Google is willing to subsidise the building of houses in Dublin, arising out of an interview Adrian Weckler did with Google CEO Sundar Pichai. The paper also runs with the lead editorial related to that story under the headline Google's housing proposals deserve a decent hearing. And elsewhere, Mark Keenan examines the history of companies providing housing for workers. The Echo, meanwhile, leads today with the story about how an average of 100 applicants are competing for every social house that becomes available in Cork County. Prominent Belfast solicitor Michael Brentnall has accused the PSNI of attempting to intimidate and harass him. That's according to the lead story in today's Irish News, which reports that the police ombudsman has already upheld three other complaints made by the solicitor against the PSNI. His most recent complaint relates to the way police handled a threat which had been made against him. An excerpt from David Cameron's biography in which he talks about coming face to face with members of the IRA during talks in Stormont in 2014 provides a lead story in the Belfast Telegraph. Over 400 Garda attacks in 3 years. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Examiner. An ESRI study has found that people order less and consume fewer calories when calorific information is included on menus. That's on the front of the Times. Rat the Baker, that's the headline which both the Irish Daily Star and Herald run with today over their lead stories related to the video which was widely circulated yesterday showing a rat emerging from a sliced pan in the Apple Green service station in Cherry Orchard in Dublin, which has been temporarily closed down as a result of that video. Attendance levels at Greyhound tracks has dropped by 20% since an RTE Investigates documentary exposed the mistreatment of dogs in the sector. That figure has emerged as the Irish Greyhound Board is due to give evidence to the Public Accounts Committee today, and that story is also carried in most of today's papers. Minister of State Jim Daly is to retire from politics after the next election. That's in The Independent. And the Examiner reports today on an appeal to onboard Planola for planning, which was granted to Kerry County Council to restore diving boards at Phoenix, which has been lodged by members of the swimming club, which once maintained the original boards. And finally, you might have heard about the death of 87-year-old Joseph Toohey, originally from Toomavara in County Tipperary, who died alone in a nursing home in London during the summer. When Margaret De Bruin, a volunteer with the Friends of the Forgotten Irish Emigrants charity, was contacted by a homeless centre in London after Joseph's death, she arranged to bring his body home and invited people to attend his funeral. She also discovered that Joseph was brought up in an orphanage after his mother was sent to a Magdalen laundry when he was 5. Speaking to today's Examiner, Margaret says that she has been overwhelmed by the response from people who want to attend Joseph's funeral, some of whom think they might be related to him, and others who just want to honour his memory. His funeral service takes place this day week in St. Joseph Church in Glasthoole in Dublin.
May he rest in peace. Fiona, thank you very much. 11 and a half minutes past 8 on Morning Ireland, coming up after the break. Two Irish students on why they're joining millions around the world in the fight to save the planet. Thousands of students in Ireland will go on strike from school for one day today as they join millions of others all around the world as they protest against climate change. It's 1 year since Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg inspired a global movement of students to take to the streets to call on their governments to address arguably the biggest issue of this and future generations. We'll talk to two students here in just a moment. But first, here's Greta herself, who sailed to New York for next week's UN Climate Summit.
This is not a drill. My name is Greta Thunberg. We are living in the beginning of a mass extinction. Our climate is breaking down. Children like me are giving up their education to protest. But we can still fix this. You can still fix this.
That's Greta Thunberg there with her call to action. Well, all around the world, people are coming out in protest. Let's hear some of the sounds now from Kilimantang in Indonesia to the town of Geelong and Melbourne in Australia.
It is their duty to protect our planet, and so far they have failed. As we progress through this time of great luxury that comes at a cost that I think we don't truly understand, or perhaps more accurately appreciate, it is more vital than ever for positive change to come around. This is the damage we have inflicted on ourselves, and this is the damage we must fix. It is no ideal of mine that this is a solution that can miraculously happen overnight. You know, it might take days, weeks, years even, but before resolution, there must be a drastic change.
Students from those parts of the world where the global action on climate change has already been taking place this morning. Well, joining us now on Morning Ireland are two students, 14-year-old Saoirse Exton, who's in our Limerick studio, and with us here in Dublin, 15-year-old Gráinne O'Sullivan from Bray in County Wicklow, and they both have a parent with them in this morning. Gráinne, first of all, Greta Thunberg there, we heard a clip of her calling on people to do what they can in relation to this issue. Did she inspire you?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I heard her first speak at a European event, and I just, because I have sustainability as a class in my school, we'd kind of heard her speeches in that class, and then to hear the words that she spoke and see her kind of tear up, and she kind of had a personal connection. I think to see that personal connection, I felt, oh, this is seriously a problem. Like, if one person feels so scared about such an issue, then maybe I should be too.
Saoirse, what about you? Did Greta inspire you, or what inspired you to do this today?
Yeah, Greta did inspire me. I have always been scared of climate change, but I've suppressed it a lot, you know, over the years. And then I saw Greta striking and I was like, whoa, she's doing something. So maybe I can do something too.
And Saoirse, where do you get your information from in relation to what's happening and the dangers that are facing our planet?
Well, I read lots of news articles in lots of different newspapers. And, you know, I keep up with things on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, social media is actually a huge help. It's been a huge help with actually finding out about things, you know, reading articles that people have tweeted about, reading articles that people have linked to. It's great, yeah.
Grainne, what about you and your information?
Yeah, a lot of it does come through social media. And then I have sustainability as a class in my school. So it's great because you hear these things on social media, but in other schools there's no space for you to talk about it. So you're getting worried about these issues, but then there's nowhere to discuss it. And I think it's really great, like in my school and in Cork Educate Together, there's space for that to talk about. So you can kind of get which is the facts and which isn't. And yeah, it's great.
You're all future voters, of course, and that, I suppose, is the language that politicians understand ultimately. Grainne, what are you saying to them this morning?
I think that we're demanding action. So they have an action plan. There is no action on it. And that's what we are demanding. We don't want just talk. We want the action that follows.
Specifically what?
Mostly kind of that the government ensures like all fossil fuels are left in the ground and no new fossil fuels infrastructures are built. 100% renewable energy. And that the government actually communicates the severity of this crisis to the general public, because there are people that still aren't aware how serious this issue is.
Saoirse, what are your demands specifically? Because obviously this is it's a global issue, it's a national issue, and they're both feeding into each other. So for you, what should this government's priority be?
Well, I definitely agree with Grace there, and about education. For instance, in my school, we don't have anything like sustainability classes. We're not taught about that. We're not taught about the severity of it, and we're not taught about how to look after ourselves. I've been telling people about it, and I'm not a climate scientist, so I don't know all the points, and I don't know everything about it. I just tell them as much as I know, and they get scared, and they say, how are we supposed to survive this? And I'm like, I don't know. You know, so I think education is very important. And then the other thing would definitely be looking after the biodiversity in Ireland. Our biodiversity is incredibly unique. And Ireland used to be almost an entirely forested nation, and now it has barely any forests left. And people have begun to forget what those forests look like. And then looking at the Climate Action Plan, they suggest using Sitka spruce trees for the reforestation of Ireland. Sitka spruce trees actually destroy the biodiversity, and they're not using native trees. So that's a big, big demand for me, yeah.
Okay, and Grainne, in relation to the fossil fuels, I mean, have you read the Climate Action Plan? Or
yeah, I have, yeah. And when I'm looking at it, sometimes I think that sometimes there's no dates for these actions. Mm.
But there's a lot of dates, is there not? I mean, yeah, it all centres around 2030.
Yeah, 2030. But by that stage, we want it before then. We have 11 years to kind of act on this. And after that, this is irreversible. So really, it needs to be done before that 11 years happens. Mm. We don't want everything to happen in 2030 and then not everything be done, because this is our future that needs to be respected. And the government are currently not respecting our future.
But they say they want 70% of our electricity from renewables by 2030. They want all fossil-fueled cars essentially done away with by the end of 2045. Heating systems ended by 2035. It's not going to happen overnight. I mean, you accept that, presumably. It's a very slow process.
Yeah, it does. It takes a while. And That's why we need it to be happening as soon as it's possible. It can't just be years down the line that they decide, oh, maybe we should start doing about something this. Currently, they're just talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk. This needs to happen. They need to act on it. We need, like, we don't need 70%. We need 100%.
Saoirse, what have you changed, I suppose, in your own life to demonstrate your commitment to climate action?
Well, we have an electric car at home, and we also have some. We have loads of trees in our garden that have been growing for several years. A lot of them, I think most of them are native trees. We grow some of our own food. Not a lot of it, but we do grow as much as we can. You know, we have like carrots and radishes and loads of apples and courgettes as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Grainne, I suppose over the last week in particular, we've heard quite a bit about the unsustainability of the fashion industry, the fast fashion, how cheaply it's made because it's wearable only on a couple of occasions and then it's thrown away. I mean, do you think ethically about your clothes and where you buy them and how you buy them?
Yeah, definitely. Like when I try to make as many responsible decisions I can towards actions like that. So when, like, I try to buy vintage clothes, and that's something anyone can do at home. You go to a charity shop or a vintage shop. There's like hundreds around the country, and not buy new clothes. Like there's hundreds of clothes in the world that there's thousands and billions of pieces of clothing that can last us for years, and yet they're still making more clothes in fast fashion industries.
So Saoirse, just finally today, what are you expecting there in Limerick?
I'm expecting a big crowd. I'm expecting people will be angry, especially over the recent how EPA recently allowed the Irish cement to begin incinerating waste in the plant.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier on the program.
I heard that. I'll be expecting lots of angry people, I think, in a good way, though. You know, positively angry.
Okay. And Grainne, what are you looking forward to today?
Yeah, well, I think it's great. It's very exciting because in Dublin we've been planning for weeks, and then for it to finally come to this day, it's very exciting, and we're hoping for really big numbers as the adults are joining us this time. And there's thousands of students that have signed up on the action maps around the country. So it's really exciting. Okay. Hopefully big numbers.
Well, good luck to you both. And thank you for taking part in our discussion on this issue this morning. 15-year-old Grainne O'Sullivan from Bray, 14-year-old Saoirse Exton joining us from our Limerick studio this morning. It's 25 past eight.
Now, school secretaries who are members of the trade union FORSA are beginning a work stoppage this morning in a dispute over pay and conditions. Protests will take place at 250 schools across the country, while up to 1,000 schools are expected to be affected by the stoppage. Thereafter, they will commence a significant work to rule. Our industry and employment correspondent Ingrid Miley is at North Dublin National School Project in Glasnevin, where strike action is getting underway. And before we speak to Ingrid, she's been speaking to school secretary Maeve Hurrell, who's been a secretary for 28 years. This is what she had to say.
I'm the longest serving member of staff, and I don't have the same rights and conditions as the other members of staff because I'm a grant paid secretary. I don't feel the same valued as the same other members of staff, and it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. I work front of house out of a government building, but I'm not a civil servant. We'll go as far as we have to go, I think. It's not, you know, rocket science. There aren't that many of us. And it will tidy up the system. It will be better for schools as well. And it will be better for the person who comes after me to have rights that I haven't had all of these years. It's just to be valued. I suppose I'm old-fashioned in that way that you like to think.
So Ingrid, just remind us, why are the secretaries striking today?
Well, basically, this goes back to a two-tier pay system. There are two groups of school secretaries. Some are hired directly by the Department of Education. And as Maeve said, they have the status of public servants. That means that they have fixed pay scales, they have paid holidays, they have all of those benefits and a pension. The ones who are funded through a grant to boards of management of individual schools do not have that status. Many of them have temporary contracts. They can earn as little as £12,500 a year. And Maeve herself has to sign on every summer when the schools are closed because there isn't holiday pay to cover those periods. So they're arguing that this is an unfair situation and that they want the school secretaries paid through board of management grants to be brought up to the same level as the Department of Education funded secretaries.
Now, there was a meeting on Wednesday with the department. What happened at that meeting?
Well, nothing. It failed to resolve the situation, and it was at that point that FORSA confirmed that their industrial action was going ahead. So what's actually happening is there will be an hour-long stoppage at, there'll be protests at 250 schools around the country, but once the secretaries go back in, they're going to start effectively a work to rule, in that they are not going to be engaging with any public service administrative systems. They argue that if they're not paid as public servants, treated as public servants, with the benefits of public servants, then why should they engage with the public service systems that are in the schools? Now, initially, there'll only be one system that will be affected, but it will affect the capture of data for the Department of Education, and that's quite important. They need to know how many pupils are in the school, how many are out sick, and all of that data goes into planning for various projects and projections. So I think that we won't see an immediate shutdown. The union argues that this will not impact on pay on pupils. It'll be an administrative difficulty for the department. But clearly, it is unhelpful to the department that this is happening. The department has described this as unwarranted and premature. They say that they're carrying out a survey at the moment to assess the scale of the problem, and that once that survey is complete, they'll be happy to, as they said, consider this fully. But I think that the secretaries say that this has been going on for decades, that they're not going to tolerate it for much longer, and that if this isn't resolved in the shorter term, they will escalate their non-cooperation.
And Ingrid, I suppose you mentioned the public service systems that they won't be taking part in today, but of course secretaries do a huge amount of work in schools, don't they? So if there are further work stoppages, will the schools and pupils then begin to be affected?
Well, it could be, yes. I mean, like this morning, it's only an hour. It'll be finished at about 9:30. I'm here at the North Dublin National School Project. I'm looking at the children coming into school with their parents, and the protest is going to get underway shortly. We'll wait and see how much support has come. But I understand that a lot of the managers in the schools are incredibly sympathetic to their secretaries, because they know that the secretaries do everything from picking up children who've fallen in the playground to the administrative stuff, phoning parents if there's a problem. You know, they are, if you like, the Castrol GTX that lubricates the school. And I think that one difficulty could be that it's only if they escalate to some sort of full stoppage that people might realise exactly what it is that they do.
Okay, Ingrid, thank you for joining us this morning. Our industry and employment correspondent, Ingrid Miley, at the North Dublin National School Project in Glasnevin, where strike action is underway.
Apple Green has reported a big jump in revenues and profits for the 6 months to the end of June as it continues to expand in Ireland, the UK and the US. Group revenue at the fuel and service station operator jumped by 73% to €1.5 billion, while its group gross profit soared by 145% to €268 million. MMD Construction has announced the creation of 100 new jobs as it opens its €6 million headquarters at the Cork Airport Business Park. ESB Group has reported higher operating profits of €294 million for the 6 months to the end of June. The group continues to invest in energy infrastructure and reported capital investment worth €396 million as it continues to plan for a low carbon energy future. Royal Bank of Scotland has named Alison Rose as its new chief executive, making her the first woman to lead one of the UK's big four banks. Let's take a look at the currencies. €1 buys 88 pence sterling and $1 10.6 cents.
John Murray's got the sport. It's finally here, John.
It is indeed. The long wait is over, Maggie. Rugby World Cup 2019 gets underway later this morning when hosts Japan take on Russia in Ireland's Pool A. It kicks off at 11:45. Coverage of the game and the opening ceremony begins on RT2 television at 10 o'clock. From an Irish perspective, the team to play Scotland on Sunday was announced by Joe Schmidt this morning. Jordan Larmour will play at full back. Andrew Conway and Jacob Stockdale on the wings. Bundee Aki and Gary Ringrose in the centre. And Conway Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton at half back. The front row is made up of Keane Healy, Rory Best and Tadhg Furlong. The second rows are James Ryan and Ian Henderson. And the back row, Peter O'Mahony, Josh van der Fleer and CJ Stander. And the replacements are Niall Scannell, Dave Kilcoyne, Andrew Porter, Tadhg Byrne, Jack Conan, Luke McGrath, Jack Carty and Chris Farrell. Josh Smith has been explaining his team selection to Michael Corcoran.
I think the forward pack are reasonably robust throughout. They're fully available. And the backs, you know, it's only Robbie Henshaw who's not available. I think everyone else could play. But, you know, I think Keith has hit some really good speeds in training on Wednesday. Rob Carney will be ready to train today. And Joey Carberry's trained throughout the week. But they're all playing a little bit of catch-up. And the problem is, if you put them in and you've got a tournament like this and they're a little bit underdone, then you've got a risk that you potentially cause another injury. We don't want to take that risk. It's early in the tournament. And we've got faith in the young boys who are going in, the likes of the Jordan Lamas. And Andrew Conway has been really good for us when he's played. He's come on in some big games and he started some big games.
Well, here to talk to us about the team and the wider Rugby World Cup is former Irish head coach Eddie O'Sullivan. The team chosen, Eddie, are you surprised?
Well, given that he's announced that the injured players are not injured any longer, except Robbie Henshaw, it's surprising that he hasn't, he's gone with Lorimer at full-back. Lorimer hasn't really a good track record at full-back. He struggled there the last time he played there. It's surprising with Rob Kearney, if he's available, as he says he is, that he's not starting him. That's a big shock.
He seems to be saying he's undercooked.
Yeah, well, he wasn't undercooked. Like, he played the last warm-up game. He's picked up a niggle, no question or doubt about that. But he's either fit or he's not fit. He's saying he's fit, but he's resting him. It just doesn't make sense. You're going into the most important game in the pool, because if Ireland win this pool game on the weekend, they basically book their place in the quarterfinals, and they can have a clean run through the tournament up to the quarterfinals, win the pool out, get their confidence. If they lose on the weekend, then they have no wriggle room after that. So to go in without your starting full back, even though he's available, it just surprises me that that happened like that.
And the game itself, I mean, would you be worried with the choice of the back three or any other selections that might impinge on the result?
I think the back three are a weak spot now, because Earls is gone as well. So that back three hasn't really played together before. So you can be sure the Scots will test this. Lorimer struggled under the high ball the last time he started for Ireland full back. In Lansdowne Road, I think it was last autumn, and he's not trying to test it. I'm sure he'll be tested on Saturday in that department. I think across the board, other than that, it's a fairly regular selection. I think Jack Conan could feel hard done by, because he had kind of, in the warm-up games, played better than CJ Stander. CJ Stander had a decent game against Wales in the last game, but he's going for Stander as tried and tested as a physical ball carrier, although I think Conan could feel miffed about that. I think the rest of the team picks itself after that.
Joe Schmidt said also at his press conference that he will sort of be certain that Ireland will be hard to beat on Sunday.
Well, yeah, they are. Ireland are always hard to beat because they're good discipline. They don't make mistakes. They don't play around their half. You know, and in wet conditions, they're probably best set up with Sexton at 10 and Murray at 9 to win that a wet day game. But I think Scotland, at the same time, fancy their chances. When Scotland beat Ireland in the last 15 years or so, it's been a shock, you know. But Scotland got us in Murrayfield a couple of years ago, getting their game plan right today. So they're basically want a one-off performance on the weekend to catch us. I think we've given them, we've let the door a little bit ajar by the back three we've picked, I think. Maybe Lauren will prove us all wrong. And again, I would always defer to the coach having the final say on selection. He has seen Lorimer up close in training. He knows what he's about. But on the evidence we have watching and playing, I think Rob Kearney would be much better bet at fullback. If I had Rob Kearney fit, I'd put him in there on the weekend, because if it goes wrong in the back three, it could be the undoing of the team on a day like that.
What about the choice of the pack?
I think the pack was straightforward. I said Jack Conan was a guy you might feel hard done by. I thought he'd played very well in the warm-up games. He'd seen off CJ Stander, but I think he's a lot of faith in Stander about getting us over the gain line in his carries. So he's gone back with Stander. Peter O'Mahony always had to come in the back row, because particularly of his line-up prowess. We couldn't possibly go in with the same back row we played Wales in the last warm-up game. And I think James Ryan, Henderson, maybe people thought Klein, but I think Henderson, again, is a better line-up option than Klein. So he's bolstered his line-up, which makes sense, because Scotland is the other place Scotland will go after, so that the line-out. They've done it before. They'll try and put huge pressure on Rory Best. And if it's a wet day as well, a slippery ball, we'd need to have our lineup buttoned down, or we could get in trouble there as well.
The game of the weekend is obviously the clash between the All Blacks and South Africa tomorrow. What way do you see that going?
I wouldn't be shocked if South Africa won it, and I don't think New Zealand would panic if they lost it. I mean, New Zealand have two wings who have only a handful of caps between them. It's the most unsettled New Zealand side I've ever seen at a World Cup. When you consider that, they're not even sure what their midfield is. Bowden Barrett's playing a full back. The world player of the year is out half, it's not even starting in his best position. That's been a problem from right through the summer. Richie Munga is a very good 10, but he doesn't control the game like Barrett. Barrett, a fullback with less touches on the ball. So that was a huge call for Hansen. And if they were to lose, they'd get a lot of criticism for not starting Barrett at 10. And their two wings are very inexperienced, but great strikers, but never really tested at this level. So I think the more settled team of the two there is South Africa. They know what they're about. There's no secret to how they play. Full frontal assault regardless of casualties, but they could nick it on the weekend, and I don't think New Zealand would panic. Hansen's has referred to that already by saying it's who wins the final that counts, and he probably is designing that more than that.
All right, Eddie O'Sullivan, thank you for joining us this morning. Eddie's headed over to our TV studios. The coverage of the World Cup begins at 10 o'clock this morning. In other sports news, in Europa League soccer, three wins, a draw and a defeat for the British teams in action last night. Teenage winger Bukayo Saka scored his first goal for Arsenal as the Gunners beat 10-man Eintracht Frankfurt 3-0 away from home. Manchester United made heavy work of beating Kazakhstan side Astana. The deadlock was eventually broken after 73 minutes by 17-year-old Mason Greenwood in the 1-0 win at Old Trafford. In Group E, Rennes and Celtic drew 1-1. Ryan Christie scoring from the penalty spot for the Hoops, who had Bayo sent off late on. Rangers won 1-0 at home to Feyenoord, Ojo with the goal. But Wolves were beaten 1-0 at Molineux by Portuguese side Braga. The Irish contingent are well off the pace after the opening round of the BMW PGA Championship at Wentworth. Paul Dunn shot an 80, Rory McIlroy a 76, Padraig Harrington a 73, and the best of the bunch was Open champion Shane Lowry, whose level par 72 is some seven shots behind first round leader Matt Wallace. Meanwhile, on the PGA Tour, a great start by Waterford's Seamus Power in the Sanderson Farms Championship. He shot a 7 under par 65 to lie just one shot off the lead held by Tom Hogue. There's racing today at Ballinrobe. The first is off at 3:30. For sports news updates during the day, you can check out the RTE News Now app and RTE.ie.
The numbers of Irish people leaving this country is greater than the numbers returning. The Central Statistics Office says that around 29,000 people emigrated in the past year, 2,000 more than the numbers who came back. Well, this formed the backdrop to a conversation on social media this week where people shared their stories about leaving the high-cost city of Dublin and Ireland for life elsewhere. Our reporter Cian McCormack has been speaking to some of them.
I left Dublin in April, just past, to afford life in Dublin. I was taking on extra work and my studies were suffering.
Leaving Dublin.
The rent was progressively eking upwards and we weren't able to save.
These people have done just that.
We could see that something needed to give and Dublin wasn't going to offer us a future as far as we could see it.
High rents, long commutes and quality of life motivated them to move.
And I think I just reached a stage in my life where I felt that I was spending far too much time sitting in traffic, far too much time working and not enough time with family and friends.
And hundreds of people shared these kind of stories on social media this week. When did you move to Brussels and why?
Well, I moved in August. Basically, a few months ago, I got the dreaded text, I suppose, from the landlord. He was looking for about €700 extra a month.
Journalist Kevin Purcell was prompted to share his story on Twitter when satirists and comedians, the Rubber Bandits, tweeted to find out why people are moving from Dublin.
Then I suppose I clicked on daft.ie. I had a look and, there's a few places around, but I would have had to spend most of my salary to just live there.
Kevin's story was one of over 600 responses to the Rubber Bandits tweet.
And I just thought, what kind of life is that for someone like me, a professional in their 30s? So I said, it's time to pack up and move on. If I was to be forced to leave Ireland in the past, it would have been like many other people during the recession where I didn't have a job and I had to maybe go to Australia or New Zealand. I was lucky enough to have just enough hours at that stage to get by. I didn't think I'd be forced out when I have a job, a full-time job, a good job, but nowhere to live. It's a strange one to get my head around.
27-year-old PhD student Caitlin White from Nenagh in County Tipperary has also left Dublin.
I had been living up there for 4.5 years to afford life in Dublin. I was taking on extra work to the detriment of my research. And at the end of it all, I'd still be waiting for the next paycheck. So like that wasn't really sustainable. So I decided to leave Dublin and move back home to Tipperary and to commute to college between 2 or 3 times a week to save on rent and living costs.
How many hours are you spending commuting now?
To go up and down in the one day, it's roughly 3 hours from here to college and then 3 hours home. I'm lucky because I'm a student, so I get student fares on the train. So it costs about €25 each day that I do it.
What about your friends in Dublin? Do they find themselves in the same situation?
Absolutely. I have so many friends who are actually considering doing the same. I've been talking to at least 3 different ones in the past 2 weeks. They are working full time up in Dublin. So they're not students. They just can't get ahead of themselves. They can't save anything. They think that maybe their only option to try and get ahead and maybe save for a deposit for a house is to move home to Nenagh and try to commute to work up to Dublin every day.
Rory McKiernan, a former member of the Council of State, moved to Lahinch in County Clare a year ago.
My motivation was the pressure, the relentless pressure of the Dublin housing market and the increasing rents and the lack of security also.
A better quality of life and a sense of community have been pluses for McKiernan. But there are challenges too.
So some of the challenges would be that there is a housing crisis in Clare also, and particularly on the West Coast, a lot of the housing is taken up with holiday homes and Airbnb. There's challenges around broadband, public transport, and indeed the weather, which is well documented. But the pros really are the natural wonder, the spectacular nature of the West of Ireland. Being out of a certain kind of a bubble, I feel, allows me to think clearer and to do better work. And I think just overall a sense of well-being, and that's very much rooted in nature, but also community. And there's a very, very strong sense of community.
The stories that emerged on social media this week reflect reality for Trinity College Dublin economist Ronan Lyons.
I mean, you can't dismiss this as just a sort of an echo chamber on Twitter talking about how tough it is to rent. But when you look at the numbers, on average, Dublin needs 12 or 13,000 rental properties put up online every 3 months in order for rents not to get dragged up. It's currently seeing half that and has seen about half that for the last 5 years.
High rents are turning norms on their head. Cities are exporting people rather than attracting them. Again, Ronan Lyons.
We've become this upside down country where we're exporting people from our cities to rural areas, not because the rural areas are thriving in terms of employment, but simply because we're not building enough housing. The group that's being affected most are people between the age of 20 and 30, and we're simply not providing the opportunities. And they may decide to move somewhere else in Ireland, but they may decide to move elsewhere in the world.
On top of this, Dublin's high rents make the city the costliest in the Eurozone.
Absolutely. I'd be quite concerned about how housing has impacted the city's competitiveness and the country's competitiveness. So about 3/4 of the overall cost structure of the typical IDA project now is labour costs. And what does labour spend its money on? Well, the number one ticket item is housing. So roughly 1/3 of your spending is on housing. So if you take that 1/3 and the 3/4, you end up with housing being about 1/4 of Ireland's competitiveness or of Dublin's competitiveness.
Stephen Kinsella, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Limerick, has similar concerns.
The key challenge for multinational companies is getting really, really high-skilled workers. And multinational companies don't look at Ireland as the only source of high-skilled workers. They look globally. So the question is, can you attract the very, very best computer programmer, the very, very best software engineer to your firm? And the answer to that is yes, if you pay them a lot, but if they're going to struggle to find a house and a good school for their kids and a nice park for the kids to play in, then that's going to be a much harder sell. So to the extent that current rental pressures and the current urban planning system damages Ireland's competitiveness.
And for people sharing their views about leaving Dublin on social media this week, change needs to happen because they say people's lives are under pressure.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is people being squeezed to the point where they just can't take it anymore and their welfare and their well-being is under so much pressure. None of us mind working or working very hard, but there has to be a trade-off for what you might call a social contract where we say we'll invest X amount of hours in working and commuting, and then we need to have a decent quality of life outside of that. And but right now, there's just the suffering is getting too much and something's going to have to give.
That was Ruairí McKiernan, who moved to lovely Lahinch in County Clare from Dublin a year ago, ending that report by Cian McCormick. You're with Morning Ireland at 8:51.
7 minutes to nine, you're listening to Morning Ireland. The weather's looking good, which is good news indeed if you're heading out and about this Friday night, because it is Culture Night tonight and it's the 14th year where 1,900 venues almost around the country will throw open their doors for free. Last year, more than 400,000 people turned up at events, and to tell us more about what's on offer this year, we're joined in the studio by Aimé von Willick, who is Culture Night National Coordinator. Aimé, the busiest woman in Ireland today, no doubt.
Today, yes, today.
And hopefully it will come. Now, I was saying that the weather is nice. Last year you didn't have such good weather, and yet 400,000 people turned up. So you, what sort of numbers are you expecting tonight?
Well, I hope we're expecting similar numbers, if not more. I mean, this year we have, as you just said, 1,900 venues, which is actually a record now. I think it's 1,950 venues opening tonight with free access to culture, and it's small studio spaces, galleries, theatres, museums, community centres, to heritage buildings and sites, cemeteries, churches, parks and more. So there's just something there for everyone.
Loads of things. And so look, if people haven't been aware yet of what's happening in their locality or nearby, let's start off and pick up a few of the highlights, Aimé. Let's start off with them. I know you've got some written down there. Let's start with Derry, shall we?
Yes, please. So in Enniskillen Castle in Fermanagh, Derry. In Derry, you can take part in circus skills tasters classes, but you can also visit the Verbal Arts Centre where there will be an exhibition entitled Drawing for Europe, which will be showcasing works by 45 children books illustrators, including Alex Scheffler, whom you may know from the Gruffalo, and they're going to be sharing their powerful visions of the European Union's shared past and unsure future. So quite topical.
Well, the Gruffalo is always a big draw, so definitely, yeah, that should be a good one. And you mentioned Enniskillen there, so we'll leave
Enniskillen as well. I suppose I'm very keen to showcase that Culture Night is taking place across the island. So in the 32 counties, in Fermanagh and Enniskillen Castle, you can experience Artsland readings where authors Carlo Gabler and Seamus McKenna will be reading selections of their stories from their Fermanagh Folk Tales collection. And just to note that these are not children fairy tales, but stories from and for adults.
We always like a bit of that, don't we? Down now into Carlow. What's happening in Carlow tonight?
So in Carlow, something completely different. Join a drag makeup and wig masterclass with celebrity makeup artist John Paul Payne at Dicey Riley's. So it's very diverse in terms of what you can experience on Culture
Loads
Night.
Loads of different things. Galway, of course, has been full of culture this week already because they launched their Galway Capital of Culture for Europe just a couple of nights ago. What's happening in Galway tonight?
Well, Galway really is, I suppose, the explosion of culture. There's so many things to view and see in Carlow, but I thought one which was quite interesting is the Computer and Communications Museum of Ireland at NUI Galway. So that's something very different. There's also outdoor tightrope walking in Chantala Park. So there's just, it's a variations of stuff.
And what about Cork?
In Cork, we have a really interesting project called the Spare Room Project. So they're going to be launching an exhibition at the former TSB premises called Spare Room Art, Architecture, Activism, and the day that's in it about activism. And that's in response to the current and ongoing, I suppose, housing and space, lack of spaces issues. And Spare Room, they focus on self-organized and creative alternative effective ways of combating precarious living.
And you mentioned activism, of course, today with the climate action protests that are happening around the country. And climate action is something that is part of Culture Night as well.
Definitely. You can see that being echoed throughout the programme in various events. It's just thinking creatively around sustainability and the arts. So there is a lovely, so in Dublin we have the Eco Village in the amphitheatre. So there's lots of different creatives coming together to do various things on sustainability and how we can approach this very creatively. And there's also the Tada Theatre in Kilkenny who are doing a workshop where they're inviting families to bring along their old and odd socks and they're going to create puppets. And I think they kind of specifically say not to bring smelly socks.
That's a great idea.
It's lovely.
We all have something to do with our odd socks, don't we? Amy, obviously there's loads happening around the country. If they weren't mentioned there, there's something probably happening close to you, if not in your own town or village. How long does it take to organise?
It takes a long time, but the great thing about Culture Night is that there's so many people involved. So there's arts organizers and programmers across the country, and of course the artists themselves who have taken Culture Night on board and owned it. So that's why it's such a fantastic event. I wanted to mention one more event,
yes, please,
if that's possible.
One more, just briefly.
In Dublin, which is a flagship event, which will be an aerial performance on a crane on Dame Street on the former Central Bank site, which is called which is going to soon to be Central Plaza.
And what time is that?
That's on at 8:45, 9:30 and 10:30. And there'll be a road closure in place, so as many people can come and experience that fantastic
performance. Everyone is welcome. Let's hope everybody enjoys Culture Night tonight. Amy van Vilik, Culture Night National Coordinator, thank you for joining us.